Good evening. Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. This week, we're going to discuss the criminalization of addiction. Let's do that one again. This week on Prison Pipeline, we discuss the need to decriminalize drug use and drug addiction. That's better. Prison Pipeline's mission is to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. And to do that, one needs to point towards solutions. Recently, I had the good fortune of speaking with Rick Lines. He's the executive director of Harm Reduction International. Rick's been working in HIV and harm reduction services, policy, and advocacy since the early 1990s. And he's known for his leading work in the areas of HIV in prisons, prison needle and syringe programs, human rights, and the death penalty for drug offenses. He started his career providing frontline HIV and harm reduction services for prisoners and ex-prisoners in Canada. He later served as executive director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust in Dublin and acted as a technical assistance advisor on HIV in prisons for several UN agencies. Rick holds an appointment as visiting professor at the University of South Wales. He's co-founder and chair of the International Centre on Human Rights and Drug Policy at the Human Rights Centre, the University of Essex, where he's a visiting fellow. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and a visiting lecturer in human rights and drug policy at the Irish Centre for Human Rights and the National University of Ireland in Galway. Rick holds master's degrees in both sociology and international human rights law, as well as a PhD in law. Rick's a member of the Strategic Advisory Group to the United Nations on Drug Use and HIV, and of the Global Fund Human Rights Reference Group. He's a former member of the Technical Advisory Group to the Global Commission on HIV and the Law, and the Reference Group to the United Nations on HIV and Injecting Drug Use. His first book, Drug Control and Human Rights in International Law, was published by Cambridge University Press in 2017. What should a good balance between drug control and human rights look like?
Well, first and foremost, we should never have any drug control interventions that violate human rights, full stop. Unfortunately, what we've seen up until really recently is that, you know, discussions and development of drug laws and drug policies have never really taken into account human rights. And at the same time, human rights organizations and human rights bodies within international organizations such as the UN have typically shied away from examining issues of drugs. A lot of it just has to go to the siloing kind of reality that you've talked about, where different organizations focus on a very limited way on their mandates and not outside of that. Part of it speaks to just the degree to which drugs have been completely stigmatized and criminalized and securitized over the last number of decades, to the degree that drug control wasn't even seen as having any human rights relevance. It was strictly, you know, about law enforcement and fighting bad drug traffickers and trying to rescue people who use drugs. And that's thankfully something that's begun to shift over the last 10 years or so, primarily driven by civil society and NGOs, ours amongst another, a group of them focusing on those issues. Been raised by certainly the voices of people who use drugs and the networks that represent them. Also, some of the organizations working in producer countries, looking at the issues of peasant farmers and growers. The work that we've really pioneered on the issue of the death penalty for drugs, looking at abuse of law enforcement in the context primarily of drug trafficking. All of these things, again, primarily being led by civil society, but with some very important assistance and support along the way from key human rights leaders and human rights bodies, have begun to shift that mechanism, to shift that discourse. Certainly the UN Office on Drugs and Crime is much more open to that sort of discourse now than they were 10 years ago. Moving from the rhetoric to the operationalization, of course, is a different a different thing altogether. We see many, many more human rights bodies taking on drug control issues. We see drug issues having a much higher prominence within a lot of the major human rights NGOs. So certainly human rights and drug control The nexus between those is certainly something that's much, much more prominent now than it was 10 years ago when I began sort of the work that ended up in that book. But still, there's still a large gap in implementation in many ways. The last couple of years, we've seen the situation in a number of key countries, from sort of the Philippines to Indonesia to the United States, sort of going backwards. So these situations are far from resolved. But certainly the human rights impacts of drug enforcement and drug control is something that's much more on the agenda now. So at least there is room to start pushing on some of those things.
And as I recall from of course, the CND meetings are webcast live, only webcast live. They don't keep those in an archive. It's really sad. But on some of these I've seen among the Russian delegate, I believe, and forgive me if I'm getting it wrong, but I seem to recall hearing the Russian delegate and possibly a couple of others say that the basic human right is to be living in a world that's free from all drugs. Or possibly it was our attorney general. I get them mixed up sometimes.
Those definitely aren't mutually exclusive. That is actually something you hear from a variety of places. Really, in response to the success and the traction that our sector has had in beginning to highlight human rights and drug control issues, that has been one of the standard pushbacks we've seen from some member states, from kind of the zero tolerance and abstinence-based NGO sector, and also even from the International Narcotics Control Board on more than one occasion, sort of creating this right to be drug-free as the kind of, I guess, opposite to looking at drug control policies that promote the right to health and, prohibit torture and inhuman and degrading treatment, protect and promote the rights of women and young people, et cetera, or don't violate those rights. So you're not alone to being confused where you might have heard that, because it's likely you heard it more than one place.
I think that as far as drug policy reformers, we've gotten better, I think, and more effective, because we have been bridging the gap between policy advocacy and the people who use drugs, advocating for actually people who use drugs, rather than seeing them as others. It strikes me that it's easy to violate the rights of an other. It's easy to abuse an other. It's difficult if you think of them as a person, someone who's in your community. And drug user, the organizing of people who use drugs, that's something that's been accelerating in the past few years. Am I just noticing it more?
No, absolutely. It's something that's definitely been accelerating again over the last 10 years. And I've always said to my colleagues who do that work that I think, the presence of organized groups of people who use drugs at these various national and international and regional policymaking meetings are not just critical in the sense of having the voices of affected populations at the table. I think they're actually critical for exposing kind of the fallacy at the base of so much prohibitionist drug law, which is essentially that people who use drugs are not capable of autonomous decision making. People who use drugs are chemical slaves, the kind of language we hear, that somehow they're, helpless victims of their drug addiction. So having, articulate, intelligent, strategically minded organizations of people who use drugs around the table actually exposes kind of the whole fallacy of that kind of rationale for policymaking. The fact that you can actually be a person who used just drugs and take part, at a very high level meeting, be very very engaged, very aware of the issues going on, be able to comment at a high level on policy, be networked in internationally with your partner organizations, again, just exposes the lie about, that really underpins so much of punitive drug control.
Some of the things that are going on in the U.S., we're finding that, and all over the world, harm reduction advocates have often found that it's necessary to bend the rules somewhat, or even just break the bloody law where it's necessary. Things like syringe exchange. In our country, syringe exchange is tolerated at all levels, really, but not really legal on many levels, depending on the jurisdiction. Safe consumption services, safe consumption sites, a number of cities around the U.S. are talking about setting up a safe consumption site. It's absolutely going to be against the law to do it now, but there are some folks doing that now. How much of the advance that's been made has been in spite of the law rather than because of it?
Oh, I think a significant amount. I think if we look at the development of harm reduction in many, many, many countries, the start of harm reduction was community-based activism. In a lot of places, whether that's people who use drugs or people who are doing broader kind of HIV or street health services, beginning to take it upon themselves to distribute syringes, as you say, or to set up safe places for people to inject indoors so they don't have to inject in back alleys or in parks and increase the risk of overdose, begin to provide access to overdose reversal medications, often before those are actually generally available or licensed. That's part and parcel of a lot of the HIV activist movement generally, when we've seen that in sort of treatment activism, people bringing medication from one country to another in at different stages in time in the HIV response. So there's always been that burning sort of righteous cause within the HIV movement generally and the harm reduction movement about, we will not let, bad laws and abusive laws get in the way of our efforts to save lives. People have been obviously persecuted and prosecuted for that in many countries in the past. I know that continues to go on in the United States at the state level at some places where syringe exchange workers can be charged with various offenses. But in many places, we see that activism has been incredibly important in creating that political space that actually results in changing laws. So, that sense of community spirit, that sense of activism, and not being willing to just be constrained by what are really ridiculous laws in the face of massive public health problems and the deaths of thousands of people. I think that's one of the real righteous elements of the whole HIV and harm reduction movement, and something we should all be proud of.
Now, of course, in this here in the U.S., where I live, we're looking at the possibility of turning the clock back. I mean, the Opioid Commission, yay, we're going to do something. Everything's law enforcement. Oh, it looks like we're going basically a question of not having learned lessons of the past. What kind of advice would you have for policymakers here in the U.S.?
Well, I think the point you've made is really at, kind of at the heart of what I look at, or the challenge at the heart of the book that I wrote, which is the fact that, drug control, as a cause or as a logic or as a body of law, certainly is an ideology that justifies and centralizes the authority of the state, essentially. Whereas human rights obviously is a body of law and a philosophy that seeks to minimize the encroachment of the state into the lives of people and into the lives of communities. So there's a fundamental conflict, you would say, between, the one body of laws that justifies and extends state control and one that seeks to push it back. And I think that's not surprising that we're seeing what we're seeing in the United States at the moment, given the current administration and the current administration's obsession with control. Of course, in the United States, we've seen very clearly the impacts of that control and the racialized impacts of that abusive form of drug control, which is an important thing to emphasize when we talk about, human rights and drug control issues. Correctly, I think, look at the abuses against people who use drugs, the abuses against people in prison for drug offenses, the people, peasant farmers who are cultivating coca, for example, or opium in different parts of the world. But the reality is, I think in most countries of the world, the people who are affected by drug laws are disproportionately people who don't use drugs. Again, the United States is a good example of this. When we look at, the incredibly authoritarian and militarized policing that we see in communities of color and poor communities across the United States. That's abusive powers that affect everyone living in that community, regardless of whether they have any relationship to the drug market. And that's where, again, where we get back to that question of drug control as a way of legitimizing state power and the authoritarian tendencies of the state. So, again, that is really a central element that makes it difficult to have some of these discussions, because certainly from a harm reduction perspective, we always have to focus on the public health successes of harm reduction and how harm reduction saves lives, how harm reduction saves the state money by preventing disease, saves the lives of people who might otherwise be vulnerable. But at the same time, when you start to scratch too far, you get into these questions of the state having to surrender a certain degree of power, which they've enjoyed over the years, certainly enjoyed through the advances in the drug control regime and the militarizing of that regime at national level in many countries. So harm reduction very quickly runs up against, that security mindset in many countries. And while it's incredibly important to argue the public health rationales and evidence in that regard, when you get to kind of broader questions of enforcement and change of laws, we obviously have a much different kind of hill to climb.
That's from an interview with Rick Lines. He's the executive director of Harm Reduction International and an expert on human rights, criminal justice, public health, and drug policies. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You are listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, we're discussing the need to decriminalize drug use and drug addiction. Could you talk for a moment about the Philippines?
Sure. Well, what we're seeing in the Philippines is just nothing other than widespread state-sanctioned criminality at an extreme level, and it's a very good example of what I said earlier about drug control being an ideology and a framework that solidifies and legitimizes the authority of the state. Because really, in many ways, and we see the more and more reports that come out of the Philippines, we see this is that that the so-called war on drugs in the Philippines has increasingly little to do with anything about drugs. Drugs is the rationale or the kind of blanket excuse that gets thrown over it, but it's really just an excuse for the regime in power to eliminate poor people and undesirable people, political opponents. We've obviously seen threats against journalists and parliamentarians and human rights defenders who even speak out against the mass killings. So drug control and drug enforcement and drug suppression is kind of the coloring around it. But at the end of the day, it's just sort of naked state oppression being acted out under the guise of drug enforcement. Of course, even if it was drug enforcement, it would be completely illegitimate and completely criminal. But again, it is unfortunately an example where we see the excuse of fighting drugs being used to justify all manner of absolutely horrific state crimes.
Indeed. Hashtag boycott the Philippines. Are there some other countries? I understand Indonesia is also looking at following a sort of a Philippine model. Are there any other countries that are heading down that road?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're seeing a lot of, quite frightening backsliding in a number of places. I mean, Indonesia began about 3 years ago or so when they reinstituted the death penalty by executing, I think it was 12 drug offenders in 1 year. And yes, this was about after a period of about 5 years when Indonesia hadn't executed really anyone. And sort of the assumption in the anti-death penalty movement was that Indonesia was quietly moving towards a moratorium because they'd really gone from a period of time of being a very high level execution state to really executing, I think they executed two people over the course of 5 years. So it was a marked change in government policy, which then switched back with the election of the new president there. And of course, as you say, now there's discussion about emulating a Philippines model. So we've seen the backsliding there is very, very frightening. You've mentioned the United States, of course, where we have been seeing some good things in drug policy, both at the national level and in terms of the U.S.'s engagement within international drug control discussions. We saw a big change between the Bush and the Obama administrations on that. Of course, that's now backsliding now with the new attorney general and the big question mark over what's going to happen now with the legalized state markets. Still remaining to see how negative this is going to be at the international level, whether we'll see sort of the U.S. Sort of siding again with Russia and others, the more reactionary states at the international level.
That was an interview with Rick Lines. He's the executive director of Harm Reduction International and an expert on human rights, criminal justice, public health, and drug policies. On Sunday, January 6th, this happened.
So we are very well prepared for the coming year. We finished very strong. One of the things we are discussing very powerfully is drugs pouring into this country and how to stop it, because it's at a point over the last number of years, it's never been like this. We've never had a problem with drugs like we did, whether it's opioid or drugs in the traditional sense. It's never been like it is. And we are going to do everything we can. It's a very difficult situation, difficult for many countries, not so difficult for some, believe it or not. They take it very seriously, and they're very harsh. And those are the ones that have much less difficulty. But we are going to be working on that very, very hard this year. And I think we're going to make a big dent into the drug problem.
That was the current president speaking at a news conference on Saturday, January 6th, following a Republican congressional leadership meeting. They were making plans for the 2018 election. So that wasn't just some middle-of-the-night tweet. That was from his prepared remarks, delivered only a minute into his presentation. Nations that he's praising include the Philippines, where more than 12,000 people have been murdered by police in the last year and a half in the name of a drug war that's really a war on the poor and dispossessed. He didn't name the Philippines in his remarks, but he's already on record as praising the drug policies of Philippine dictator Rodrigo Duterte, on whose orders those murders have been committed. On January 4th, the Justice Department issued a new memo to prosecutors regarding marijuana enforcement in states which have legalized medical marijuana or adult social use marijuana. This new memo, signed personally by Attorney General for the moment, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, rescinds all the previous memos that were issued during the Obama administration and officially returns the Justice Department to the policies of the Clinton and Bush administrations. The Ogden and then Cole memos in the Obama administration were important symbolically, yet they had limited effectiveness when it comes to actually curbing law enforcement excesses. In spite of the official spin, the Obama administration carried out a number of raids against medical marijuana businesses and also exerted pressure on landlords, even threatening forfeiture. Those memos, however, were a symbol that under Obama, the diehard drug warriors were not going to be in charge. Yet they really only kept the DOJ on a very loose leash. But still, they were at least a little restrained. Now, the leash has come off. And to continue with this analogy, the leash is off, but fortunately, the dogs of the DOJ are still fenced in by law. At a practical level, what really stops the Justice Department from going after state-legal medical marijuana businesses is the Rohrabacher-Blumenauer Amendment to the Department of Justice Appropriations Measure. That rider prevents the Justice Department from spending any funds to go after state-legal medical marijuana programs, which courts have interpreted to include legal businesses in those states. That rider has to be added to each year's appropriations bill, and it only, repeat, only covers medical marijuana. The new appropriations measure for fiscal year 2018 is very late and must be approved by January 19th in order to prevent a government shutdown. For more information about that amendment and what you can do to help make sure that that amendment remains law, get in touch with Americans for Safe Access at safeaccessnow.org. There are thousands of patients in the state of Oregon and hundreds of thousands of patients around the United States who are depending on us. And finally, we've already heard about the Federal Centers for Disease Control being warned against using phrases like evidence-based. Well, now back before the Obama administration, all the way through the 90s, the Clinton years, and then in Bush in the 2000s, the phrase harm reduction was considered taboo by researchers. Putting the words harm reduction into a grant proposal or a funding request would mean you aren't going to get funded. The feds were not in favor of harm reduction. and so people avoided it. Under Obama, we saw that change. In fact, two different directors of the Office of National Drug Control Policy addressed conferences of the Harm Reduction Coalition during the Obama administration. We haven't really heard much from this current administration about harm reduction, except on December 13th. The United States Attorney's Office for the District of Vermont issued a statement warning people who'd been discussing safe injection facilities there that, quote, exposure to criminal charges would arise for users and SIF workers and overseers. The properties that host SIFs would also be subject to federal forfeiture, end quote. Now, that's not department policy, not yet. It's only a statement from one U.S. Attorney's Office for now. The discussion about safe consumption spaces and supervised injection sites, about SIFs, has been going on for some time now, since well before the last election. Local governments in King County, Seattle, San Francisco, Ithaca, New York, and many other cities and counties around the nation are making plans or at least discussing the idea of setting up sites where people who use drugs can go to get the equipment they need and can use in a clean, sterile environment where trained medical personnel are present and can immediately respond in case of an overdose. And though it hasn't reached the level of elected officials in Portland, a number of public health experts and community activists in Multnomah County and the surrounding area are working to get that discussion started here. Safe injection facilities are in use all over the world. They've been proven to save lives and prevent the spread of bloodborne diseases. They also help people connect with healthcare and social services. They're an important intervention. If this administration works to discourage harm reduction, well, what's the opposite of reducing harms and managing risks? And I'll leave you with that thought because we're coming up to the close of the show. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline. Thank you for joining us. You can find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline at the KBOO website, kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. I want to thank my guest, Rick Lines. A heartfelt thank you to our engineers, Danielle Parks and Mike Vitaklis. A great thank you to the other members of the Prison Pipeline Collective. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.